Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, the secretive RAF Rudlow Manor. This is where they look for UFOs, but they do a lot more besides. Matthew Williams from Devizes talks about secret bunkers under Box Tunnel and Caution. Then Fran Meyer, living with disability in Bankster, Britain. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. If you have a story or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show.
My name's Matthew Williams. I'm 47 years of age, former customs and excise worker, and I've been involved in research into UFOs, government conspiracies, and more recently crop circles as well. I've been doing stuff into this secret base called Rudlow Manor, which has a large underground city, as it's been described by many who've worked there. It was a citadel for the government to retire to in a wartime situation, Second World War.
Where is it?
It's in Caution, RAF Rudlow Manor. And the manor house itself now is actually sold off. It's disused. But the base still carries the name RAF Rudlow Manor. And it's an underground complex which has been admitted to, finally, by an admiral, Navy admiral, as being 25 miles of underground tunnels, which is, as I was telling people in my publications for many years and being told I was very silly for suggesting this, and then you hear it from an admiral who actually says 25 miles of underground tunnels.
So why is it in this part of the country?
I think it was due to the type of quarry stone that was available for building Bath. I mean, the Romans were using Bath stone, and then quarries developed in that area of the countryside. And it's a very easy stone to cut because it's quite soft, so you can quarry very quickly and, you know, hew out a lot of stone. And the city of Bath has to be, you know, made with Bath stone. So I mean, you know, if you look at the size of the city of Bath, think that came out of the ground. Where's the city that you can't see? It's somewhere near Caution. That is the underground city that made the above ground city.
So is it simple, the idea being, let's just make it under here, and if we get nuked, we can survive a nuclear attack?
Well, initially it was wartime. They were trying to find munitions places to store bombs and munitions away from the Germans.
So this is World War II, before the nuclear
yes.
age.
Yes, this is before the nuclear age. And they basically had a massive munitions dump underground. And near this, in Rudlow Manor, the central position, they had a control centre, which was known as Burlington. And this is where the... there were offices for every government department. There were, apparently, in its heyday, there were 6,000 people working every day underground at peak
and
time.
So this was actually a functioning part of government rather than somewhere that people would go to in an emergency?
It was actually being used. They were storing weapons underground, and they were also in full preparation for it being filled with the ministers who were going to take their roles from London to underground at Caution. I mean, it was ready to go. I mean, it had all the communications. It had one of the most advanced telephone operator stations in the UK underground. And this was all military, hardwired, and radio. They also had a radar station there, which was known as a rotor station. And they commanded the southern sector, looking for any German aircraft that they could send out fighters to attack.
Okay, so RAF Rudlow Manor is the epicentre, really, the main node here. What about some of the other bases around there?
Rudlow Manor comprises a number of bases. There's Basil Hill Barracks, there's the newly created GCHQ, which is a story in itself, known as the GOSCC. They call it the GOSC. So if you ring them up and say, can I be put through to GOSC, please? They'll know exactly what you mean. But it's GOSCC, which is a Global Operations Security Command Centre, I think it is. And this is an offshoot of GCHQ. Recently, they were looking to employ hackers. They actually put this in the local press. Are you a hacker? Would you like to be a hacker for the Ministry of Defence? And, you know, I thought hacking was illegal. But it's okay when you've got a government hat on it. You know, it's okay to hack.
Well, you've got crown immunity, haven't you?
Well, that's right, yes. But, I mean, of course, they play these games by saying, oh, we don't hack people in the UK because that would be illegal. You know, what we do is we ask the Americans to hack for us in the UK. So they hack us and we will hack for them so that we don't break each other's laws. Under this UK-US agreement of 1950, I think it is, yes. Well, I think it's about $750 million has got spent, which is money which was given to GCHQ. And then GCHQ say, we've spent it now. But suddenly you see that a figure of $750 million has been spent in Corsham and buildings appear and data centres, which are privately owned, which is interesting. Of course, front companies for the MOD to make it look like, you know, it's not the MOD being, you know, operating these things anymore. And surprisingly, you know, for a front company, they did a very silly thing and put Elizabeth Mannington Buller, the ex-head of MI5, is one of the company directors.
She used to be known as Bullying Manor, I think.
Very good, very good.
Yeah, Manning and Buller. Yeah, so, I mean, the other thing with privatisation is really, really concerning, I think, when it comes particularly to things like signals intelligence, security services, and anything to do with the whole spy world, because, you know, a private company is not anywhere near as accountable,
exactly.
Even though actually these secret services are almost totally unaccountable, apart from there's one government committee called the Intelligence and Security Committee, which is always chaired by what they would call a safe pair of hands. In other words, an MP that never asks any questions. I think it was Sir Malcolm Rifkind at one point. It may be it's Dominic Grieve at the moment. I'm not absolutely sure. But the whole privatisation business bothers me. I mean, as what's happened with the rest of the world is that these private companies have then fallen into foreign hands. Now, surely that's a little bit awkward when it comes to something like intelligence and the secrecy and the defence of the realm.
Well, defence of the realm, and rather alarming when you find that places like Porton Down, which you think, you know, they've got the most deadly viruses known to humanity, and it was a place that stored the Novichok. They had their own supplies of Novichok. Who owns that then? You know, military? MOD? No, apparently privately owned, I believe last by a Libyan gentleman of a banking family. Rather odd, isn't it? You know, I kind of thought you wouldn't let these things be run by foreign people from strange countries, you know. I mean,
there's also another company called Kinetic, isn't there, which is big on Salisbury Plain. It was a defence evaluation research establishment, DERA, I think, that was privatised probably 20 years ago. Kinetic then took on this incredibly important role developing weapons, a private business.
Yes, and monopolies that are handed out, you know, from the MOD to their friends as well, you know, which is another alarming thing. You know, it's just corridors of secrecy and ways to hide accountability, to take the blame for anything that goes wrong away from the Ministry of Defence and say, oh, it's a private company, or we can shut that company down and start another one.
Well, look, there's another aspect to this, and that is that the whole thing of national security can be used to hide a whole can of worms. I mean, it's a bit like the way that landowners put no trespassers on the side of their land when they're doing, you know, illegal burning, illegal dumping of waste, that sort of thing. And I know you've had a few attempts anyway at actually finding out what's going on in some of these bunkers. Can you let us know how you got on?
Yeah, well, in the early days, I was kind of wandering around looking for UFOs at Rudlow Manor because we were told that it was the coordination point for UFO reports. In books like Above Top Secret by Timothy Good, this was listed as a key area. From my work in Customs and Excise, I asked a few questions, looked at it, looked in a few sort of manuals that we had for Customs and Excise, and found out that it was a highly regarded, high security facility that the customs people I spoke to said, you know, everything goes through there. It was kind of like, you know, this is a central hub. You know, our information goes through to them. We have to ring them from time to time and let them know what we're doing. You know, so they had their fingers in all the pies, and they did seem to be an intelligence center. If not on the door, definitely inside the place. But some of their bases were, you know, Rudlow Manor used to house the Provost and Security Service, which is Provost, which is police, and Security Service, which used to actually train the security services in firearms and how to break safes and things like this. So, I mean, you know, there was a lot of secret squirrel stuff going on at Rudlow Manor. I came down there looking for UFOs, came away with something completely different.
From the military point of view, a UFO could be a Russian. You know, it could be anything. It's not necessarily some, you know, we mostly associate UFOs with aliens, don't we?
Absolutely. Good point, you know, because just because it's a UFO doesn't mean it's, you know, an alien-piloted vehicle. I mean, of course the Ministry of Defence have to take an interest in any incursion into the British airspace by an unknown target, either visually or on radar. Because, I mean, Russia is always testing, or has always tested until we became friends, and then we became unfriends again because it's good for business. As we know, Mr. Putin now has to be the bad guy. You know, it's good for business. But we'd kind of stopped all this sort of watching our borders, and it almost seemed like we were becoming lax. And, you know, all this kind of, you know, security of the air was done from bunkers around the UK, rotor stations, radar stations, and all of those would have connected back to Rudlow Manor. So they weren't just a headquarters for UFO reporting, which has been confirmed by the MOD. They were also a headquarters for communication, 1001 Signals Regiment, which is based at Cologne, has some very large satellite dishes which could take a nuclear blast. They're very well protected dishes, you know, and the telephone wires that go from there go to the communication centre at Rudlow Manor. There was also a black budgeted Thatcher era bunker called the Corsham Computer Centre, CCC, which is near a place called Peel Circus in Corsham, if you want to look it up on a map. This is an underground bunker that they tried to pretend wasn't there by just not having any signs, not having any keep out signs, and just having a gate that you could just walk in from the road, open the gate, walk down this entrance into this shaft, and then you had these glass doors and a little push button, and you had to press the buzzer and sort of say who you were, and they would look at you on a security camera and let you in. And, you know, this place, if you go underground, is like the British equivalent of NORAD. It's an underground supercomputer. It's on spring-loaded floor, so that if there's a nuclear explosion that shakes the ground, it won't shake the supercomputer. You know, everything is spring-loaded underground. Yet the Ministry of Defence have jumped cartwheels to spin a story that this is just something to do with Trident, communications for Trident submarines. Or the other really pathetic explanation was, they said it's just document storage. I think their explanation was, it's just like the London buses. They've got their computers underground as well, because, you know, it's kind of a good idea. And it's like, we all know it's a command and control centre. You know, if London gets taken out, this is one of the places that takes over. Now, we wouldn't mind so much, but I mean, it's public money getting spent and the black budget, and, you know, then they're playing games with people that go there, you know, telling them that it's one thing, it's not another, and, you know, it's...
So you've had a few goes at getting into these places as various people. How have you managed to get on? And I know you always take a camera with you, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, one of the more successful times at the Corsham Computer Centre, for example, was I took an American film crew from a channel called, well, a TV program called Sightings, and, you know, with camera under his arm, walked up to the entranceway, but we were all wearing shirts, so we looked, you know, like professional sort of people. And they opened the door for us and let us into the first security section of this bunker. And then, obviously, we were confronted by a set of guys behind glass, and we had these strange booths that rotate, and you have to kind of enter one side of the booth, punch a number in, and then they let you through the other side. And if you're not who you say you are, you'll get kind of trapped in the booth, which I assume is probably bulletproof and bombproof in some way. But anyway, it was kind of funny because we came in and we got let in by mistake to this first stage of security. Well, you know, past the first doors, but into the second stage of security, almost, I suppose you'd say. And then they panicked because they could see that we had a camera with us, and we were obviously a TV crew. And then they rushed out of their security booth to come and see us, but they had to come through the rotating security booth to get to us. And in their haste, they typed in the wrong number and locked themselves in the booth. And the alarms went off. And so we were just like laughing at them through the glass, filming them trapped inside the booth. You know, they couldn't get to us, you know, to kind of stop us doing what we were doing. But eventually we were ushered out. And sadly, the tape never made it onto television. I think they felt that maybe they were pushing security by putting it on TV a little bit, but, you know, they only ever got to see the outside of it. But, yeah, you know, we've had some lucky breaks. We've kind of got into some of the bunkers through going through underground quarry tunnels nearby, as I believe you've been in some of those tunnels too. So,
yeah. What about others? Are there other people around who are doing similar things to you, like just doing what they can, people that maybe live locally that just try and find out what's going on here? Because in a way it's like a red rag to a bull. You're told there's nothing to see here. Quite clearly stuff's going on.
Well, this is why we kind of kept going with it, because we were told that the base was closing down, there was nothing to see, the underground tunnels were all disused. They even towards the end, to kind of fend off interest, they were allowing the BBC in there, various caving crews with cameras to see these underground tunnels, and they were going, look, you see, there's nothing here. Of course, they weren't taking them down the road to see the Caution Computer Centre. They weren't taking them to see the Command of the Defence Communications Network. So there were a lot of places that were still off limits, you know, that were working, but they were trying to sell this line, look, it's all closing down, we're selling it off. But they never did sell it off, you know. This is the point. How many years were they trying to sell this place off? So a number of us knew that this was a ruse, you know, that this was just kind of flim-flam to get rid of us. And we kept going. In the end, the MOD kind of gave up and said, well, hey, they all know what's going on down here. They know there's a big secrecy thing going on here. We need to expand GCHQ. We need to kind of get these hackers on board, and we need a new security centre. Why don't we just build it at Corsham? Everybody knows we're doing it, so we might as well just do it here. And suddenly, massive influx of money, massive creation of buildings, server centres, you know, private sector service centres, you know, but we know they're data centres for the MOD. They've kind of put all this money into it and said, hey, well, you know, there you go, look, we are here, let's just get on with it. So now you've got a highly secured facility there where security is back up. If you try to get into the underground quarry tunnels now, you might be met by security from the base. They've ramped up the paranoia security. One group of researchers off the internet called Exploring with Fighters. They've got this great channel where they go around doing urbex, it's called, which is just looking at old buildings, old manor houses that are derelict and things. And they decided they'd have a pop at having a look at the underground city at Rudlow Manor. I think they'd even seen some of my videos. And they looked at one of my videos and saw a way they thought they could get in. And they were exactly right, because I'd been thinking maybe I could do that too, because I was planning to do it, but they beat me to it. So well done, boys. But they got into this area that was being developed with a housing estate around it, with a bunker still in the middle of the housing estate, which is kind of weird, you know. And I thought, you know, we were all thinking, like, why is the bunker still there? Are they going to fence it off so you can't see it? And these lads thought, well, let's see if we can get in this bunker entrance. And yes, you could. And yes, it does lead down into these old military tunnels that lead up to the new used military tunnels. In fact, they're an escape shaft for the Caution Computer Centre. That's why they're not getting rid of them, because they never know whether they might need to escape out of them one day if there's a fire in the tunnels, you know. So that's why they're there. These guys got in, tripped some secret alarms when they got in, had a good look around for a few hours. On the way out, they managed to evade the security people that were there waiting to pounce on them, jumped in their cars and got away, published their stuff on the internet. But when they came back, I offered to sort of show them around a little bit. But within minutes of us coming into the edge of the sort of edge of Corsham, we were picked up. Security knew we were there, and they caught us on a little road going past a disused base, and they were all over us, like, why are you here, what are you doing? And it was, you know, it's sort of, well, why are you asking us? We're just driving up a road towards some houses, and we've just turned round, we haven't done anything. Why are you sort of on top of us?
So do you find that you get pulled over quite a bit by the police? I mean, obviously they know who you are, you live locally, I wonder how much freedom of movement you've got these days, Matt. And I mean, what methods are they using to track? Have you any ideas?
They made my life hell for many years. They used to pull me over all the time in England and in Wales. My car was flagged up, you know, for stop this man at all costs and harass him. I lost my license because of a safety belt issue with them, and they were following me for an hour and a half, you know, behind me, and then I pulled into a petrol station and was ready for them. I just sat in my bonnet, like, what do you want, guys? And they're like, oh, you know, just you know, we want to know your details. I said, well, you know who I am. You know, they said, no, we don't. I said, you've been following me for an hour and a half. You know, I've been speeding up, you've been speeding up. I slow down, you slow down. And I pull into the station, but you're telling me you don't know who I am. And they're like, no, you know. So we went through this charade, and I lost my license for 6 months for not wearing a safety belt, if you can believe that. That's the power these people have, you know. They do these things. Well, these guys who went down, called Exploring with Fighters, they got a taste of it, because when we left the area that day, we were up near Gloucestershire going to look at something called the Hobbit House, you know, somewhere completely different. And suddenly the car we were in country lanes, and the car that we were in was surrounded by unmarked police cars. And then a dog vehicle turned up and another police car. So it was like five police cars. They wanted to know what they were doing at Corsham that day. And the premise they'd used for pulling them over in the first place was that their plates had been cloned, apparently. They'd been cloned and used for crimes in London earlier on that day. You know, and it's like, yeah. So I was just like smiling, going like, thumbs up, like, here you go, boys, I told you. They knew when we got into town. They knew when we were there minutes after coming to Corsham, they knew we were there. And when we drove away at the end and we were in a different part of the countryside, they knew exactly where we were.
So do you think it's just tracking mobile phones? That's the methods they use,
yeah.
Do you think?
Yeah. Hey, folks, listen, if you want to go and do this stuff around bases, you're going to have to turn your phone off or leave it at home. Because once they get to know you, it's going to give away your presence. It's going to give away that you're there at these bases. So you're going to have to leave your mobile phone at home. And if you've got a car, you're going to have to use different cars each time, because the ANPR systems they've got are, you know, they're going to give away your presence. So
this is the thing that the side of the road, yeah, that will send a message about number plates that are going past the camera as the cars go past.
That's right, yeah, ANPR. Sorry, I forget, the people may not know what this is. Automatic Number Plate Recognition System, I think it is. Number Plate Recognition, yeah. So ANPR will log cars right up and down motorways, on country lanes, in towns, wherever one of these cameras is secretly hidden. The police will keep a record of your movements, which can be backdated. They can look to see what you've been doing, where you've been driving for years into the past. And the first place I ever experienced the use of that type of system was at Rudlow Manor, because they had this system in there about 15, 20 years ago, before anybody knew what ANPR was.
I think it was developed originally in Northern Ireland during the Troubles.
I had heard this, yes, and it was definitely deployed in Rudlow Manor, probably around GCHQ and various other bases of interest. And, you know, you'd only have to go in your car to the base area and just park up in a housing estate, and the police would be there. Bump, they'd know you were there. They'd know exactly where you were and, you know, what are you doing in the area. They just like to let you know. They know that you're there, so don't try doing anything. They like to, it's kind of like this over sort of seeing eye that they like to kind of scare people, and, you know, they will investigate you. They will look into you.
There's a genuine need for security as well, isn't there? So, I mean, we'd be a bit stupid if they didn't have something similar.
Sure. I mean, my statement has always been this on why we've done what we've done and gone into the underground quarries and taken photos and published it, is because, A, we can, because there's nothing to stop us doing it legally, and, B, because we'd like to see what's going on, because the Ministry of Defence don't tell us what they're doing. They have lied to us with the UFO subject, which is my primary area of interest, but they've also lied in other areas by saying that these bases are closed down, there's nothing going on. You know, it's just kind of, I think, you know, people have a right to know in the free world what the military are spending money on. Are they being experimented on without their knowledge? You know, this has happened in the past. We have to ask questions. The public have a right to ask these questions for our own safety and our own security. But then when you get rumbled by these base security guys, yeah, okay, they've rumbled you, but you are actually putting them on their toes and making sure that they maybe, you know, they're more prepared for when somebody who shouldn't be there, who's got, you know, less than honourable intentions as journalism, you know, when they've got people like that turning up as well. And I've got to say that I think we helped probably along that lines. You know, we helped the base security by actually triggering them a number of times and getting caught, because, you know, that's what their job is. That's what they're meant to do. And I think they should have been doing it a bit more, and hopefully we made them do it a bit more. Now this new GCHQ is there at Corsham, called the GOSC, the G-O-S-C-C. It's really ramped up, you know, the security is at a heightened state. You will experience some sort of, you know, collar being felt if you try anything on there these days, I think. And they're quite proud. I mean, I've spoken to the officer in charge of the base and said, can we come in and have a look at the underground tunnels now and take photography and do a tour? And he's like, absolutely not. You know, that kind of air of nicety is gone. It's back to the Cold War days. Security, a priority, terrorism, don't try it.
But the thing is with the military is they also get up to no good sometimes. I mean, we've seen live testing of biological weapons and things like that in the past on human populations. We've seen testing of biological weapons and chemical weapons on soldiers who are volunteers at Porton Down, things like that. So there's a legitimate reason to ask questions. In fact, if journalists hadn't asked questions about Porton Down, then the scores of families would never have got any compensation, you know, of the servicemen that volunteered for these trials.
Yes, I think it's journalists and it's the public's responsibility to ask questions and to look into the government files, what files there are, because a lot of them will obviously be destroyed. But what you can get hold of at the Public Records Office and what you can get hold of by just asking questions of local people. I found that the most amazing information I've ever got about Rudlow Manor and the underground base was just by asking the locals. You know, they were always a great store of knowledge, because to them, you know, their work they did 50 years ago to them would not be secret now. You know, and they may tell you little things that put the pieces together of what's going on now.
I mean, anecdotally, I've spoken to people who have worked at Corsham, and they've said things like, well, there's this all these American computers arriving. We're not happy with it, actually, because, for example, the US military and staff who are coming to install these computers don't speak to us. They're almost, we feel like Britain is being used.
Yeah, yeah. I won't say where and when, I won't identify where, but I mean, I spoke to somebody who worked in a base, and he said that American systems are being installed, and that because of the software is considered proprietary to the private companies that make the software, even the American government is not really empowered or able to force these American private companies to release the code of what their systems do. So these systems are installed.
You mean to the British authorities?
The British authorities, to the British military. So the British military almost have to surrender, you know, kind of saying, plug into our systems and plug into our backbone and plug into our spinal cord and do whatever you're going to do with systems that we don't fully understand what you're doing, whether you're actually spying on our stuff.
So it's a sort of plug in and trust us.
Yeah, you're not allowed to ask what they're doing. And you can kind of ask, but they'll tell you no. They'll say, no, you can't see the inner workings of our system. You can't actually operate it with us. You can kind of float around in the background, but we have to operate it. We have to be in control of it, you know, and not, you don't know what we're doing. I mean, it's kind of like the nuclear situation where Britain didn't have their finger on the nuclear button. If it was American missiles, American systems in the UK, Britain would say it would mandate whether or not it could, you know, the Americans could fire the systems, but it was the Americans could fire them whether they liked anyway, because they had control of them.
What about something like the so-called independent nuclear deterrent, something like Trident? Mm. How independent is something like that? It's an American system, but the British sort of boast that this is our independent deterrent.
Well, Boeing invented, I believe, Boeing is Trident missiles made by Boeing. British Aerospace might be in there somewhere, because what they want is they want the work from the resupply and the servicing of this equipment. But I mean, you know, you might be allowed to replace a component, but you don't know what that component does, because it's made by Boeing and that's proprietary, you know. So you can plug in a card, but you're not allowed to know what's on the chip of that card. You might be able to replace the nuclear material, the fissile material, the warheads, you know, the rocketry fuel, you know, service the gaskets. You can do all that stuff, but you don't know what's in the warhead. And the warhead is controlled by the United States. So, you know, if Britain fired a warhead, America could press a button and blow it up. They service the warheads, but the chip, the software, the hard-coded material that's inside that is not necessarily open to, you know, scrutiny by British eyes. So they could have a system whereby we own the missiles, we paid for them, but they're made by America, and if we fired them, America could say no and destroy the missile before it comes down on its target. America could have that final veto say, because what is in those software systems that run these missiles?
Oh, it's lovely sitting here in Wiltshire near Devizes. We've got all sorts of stuff going on in Wiltshire, haven't we? We've got Porton Down, which is the chemical and biological weapons base. And we've also got Boscombe Down, which is used for test flying by the RAF, one of the longest runways in the country. as well as Rodlay Manor that you've been talking about. But I can't have a chat to you, Matt, without asking you about this whole Novichok Skripal affair.
You've obviously got the British-controlled run press, and they're telling one story. You've got the Russian press, they're telling a different story. You've got officials from the Russian government who are literally, you know, opening their arms and saying, come and investigate, come and talk to us. And Britain's like, we don't need to talk to you because we've already made our minds up. This is the way it seems to me is, you know, the Britain has kind of folded its arms and said, we don't need to investigate, we've already decided. And I don't believe the Russians are being insincere. They would like to find out what's going on as much as the British. There may have been instances in the past where Russia has assassinated rogue officers or people that it's considered to be have done a disservice to them in the past, but I'm not sure in this case.
So what are the circumstances? Are there any circumstances in this recent story that you get your antenna out and say, hang on, that doesn't seem to make sense?
Well, what I don't understand is why a Novichok, which is supposed to be such a deadly nerve agent, would be so badly administered as to leave the main targets alive. And it incapacitated them, but didn't kill them. And this is supposed to be this deadly nerve agent, you know, and then extra supplies of this, which were literally thrown away, were found by members of the public who then administered themselves with this stuff, thinking it was possibly perfume. They killed themselves by overdosing with this stuff, but the right amount, the right dose wasn't given to kill the main target, which was supposed to be the Russian spy. I mean, talk about a botched job. I mean, would Russia really be that bad at sort of, you know, doing assassinations? That it looks like an amateur job. It looks like a panic job. It doesn't look like a well-coordinated attempt at an assassination. And why would Russia do this in the middle of the World Cup when all eyes are on Russia, you know, for kind of saying what Russia could be as an open place and a, you know, society, the walls have come down, we need to do business. And right in the middle of all of that, bang, you get a sort of a terrorist attack of this nature. And I think it's to throw attention away from things. You know, you get these false flag operations happen all the time, you know, and you have to say, look, when the media wants you to look on the right, maybe you should also be looking on the left. You know, you need to look at all sides, be listening to all information. And the general flavor I got was that Russia didn't do this. Somebody else has done this, possibly because they stand to benefit from an increase in weapon sales if we reignite the Cold War, which I know Russia has in the past indicated it would like to see a sort of soft progression back to a Cold War state, because it would be good for business. So would the UK, because arms sales are good for business. Who stands to benefit? Follow the money. Who's going to benefit out of this? It's not Putin, but it might be somebody that sells weapons in Russia or the UK.
Okay, finally, rumours around Rodlay Manor are, well, I don't know if you know the extent of the sort of miles of passageways and things around there, but there's also rumours about long-distance tunnels that could go for literally tens or maybe even hundreds of miles from Rodlay Manor. Have you had any sniffs around that subject, and what do you make of that particular rumour?
Well, if you go sniffing around military bases, you're always going to get the myths. And I was presented with a lot of these myths when I started looking into Rodlay Manor, looking for UFOs, didn't find UFOs, found bunkers, didn't really find, that it was an active base. I found out that it was probably an inactive base, and that there were these stories about the 100-mile tunnel to London, you know, and then went away from that, which were the myths, to finding out there is an active base. There's a secret side to Rodlay Manor, which they like to keep hidden. And, there's the stories about the aliens being stored, you know, at underground at Rodlay Manor, alien bodies at Porton Down. You know, I think these are the red herrings. You know, you kind of have to look past that and you have to see, you know, what's the real stuff that's going on. Because, you know, intelligence people know that they can throw out silly stories and it will draw the imaginations of the sort of wild-eyed UFO researchers, and create a kind of a silly story that will take people's eyes off the attention of what they could be looking at, which is the real money and the real story.
But there is actually a, you know, railway tunnel, isn't there? The main London to Bristol railway tunnel between Chippenham and Bath runs right through the middle of that hill.
Yeah, this was the real story, but that this London Bath to London rail line goes uphill through the Box Hill Tunnel, which was made by Isambard Kingdom Brunel. And at the high end, the London end of that tunnel, if you look at the side where the tunnel opens, there's another tunnel which goes into the hill. What they used to do is they would bring ammunition trains in at night, and they would stop them at the top of the hill, switch the tracks, open these secret doors into the second tunnel by the side of the Box Hill Tunnel, and they would actually take the trains into the hill and offload them on rail platforms underground. And this was a very efficient way of doing it. It was fairly secret because it was done at night. It was a well-kept secret for many years. Obviously, the 6,000 people that worked in the underground tunnels, they knew all this stuff was going on, but it didn't get out to the Germans. It was a well-kept secret, and subsequently, they never managed to bomb that area. You know, Monkton Farley, which was one of the biggest ammunition dumps in Europe, that never got bombed. You know, it was a well-kept secret. But yes, because they had this train tunnel going into the hill where they used to offload the ammunition, the myths got started that, you know, the train just kept going. It didn't just stop and offload its ammunition. It kept going and going and going and went all the way across the country and then curved back around and went to London. So, you know, there was an underground railway tunnel going to London as well as a real railway tunnel going to London. But of course, this is just the Chinese whispers and how things get exaggerated. So, yeah.
What about websites where these sorts of things are discussed? I'm thinking about, I think, isn't it called Subterranea Britannica? But there are a few of them now, aren't there, where, you know, people who have, in their spare time, just as a hobby, like to sort of snoop around the places that are supposed to be off the map. They don't exist.
Yeah, Subterranea Britannica is a good place to start because they try to be more accurate from a historical perspective. They do draw the line at not really discussing active military stuff, but you can draw your own conclusions from looking at the inactive military stuff that they show. Underground tunnels in London, railway tracks that were developed by London Underground that went to secret stations, and the underground post office network, you know, which was in London, which a lot of people don't know about. Fascinating stuff. I mean, it's a whole new world underneath your feet that you didn't know was there. Tunnels, you know, in cities and bunkers in the countryside, mansion houses that have secret cities underneath them, you know, and secret citadels underneath them. You know, it's a fascinating little world that we were not supposed to know about. But you know, it's Subterranea Britannica is a good place to start. Nettleden, which is Nettle D-E-N, Nettle Den is a good website. There are some others which I'm, you know, loath to kind of discuss because they go into the illegal stuff a little bit, but they also kind of micromanage what they want people to talk about, and I've fallen foul of some of these forums because they don't want you discussing things like UFOs. I've been called a kook, a crazy, because I say that at Rudlow Manor they used to investigate UFOs. You're not allowed to talk about that on these websites. In fact, Wikipedia, if you look at the Wikipedia webpage for RAF Rudlow Manor, it's been heavily censored by the MOD to take that sort of information away. But it's a fact. The MOD, on letterheaded notepaper from London Whitehall offices, have said that this was a central coordination point for all the UFO reports. They even used to send out officers to interview witnesses, plainclothes officers to interview witnesses from RAF Rudlow Manor. The files are in the public records office. You can withdraw them. You can look at the files. They're real. They did try to get rid of those files, actually, and we had to get a parliamentary questions asked to get the files returned. But they're there now for all time for you to look at to see that, yes, RAF Rudlow Manor did do this stuff. But there are methods and things you can do. There are magazines that deal with this stuff. Yeah, you know, have a look at my website, which is a lot of drone footage. I fly my drone over these bases when it's legal to do so. It's called The Secret Vault, one word, The Secret Vault. And if you have a look on there, I flew over one chemical establishment that was secretly under a village called Westwood. Is it Wiltshire or Somerset? It's just on the borders, I think. So I think you're just inside Wiltshire. Westwood had an underground bunker system, and it was taken over by Porton Down to develop chemical and biological weapons. And what they didn't tell the people who worked in this underground facility is that the guys with masks on who were developing the biological weapons were doing them in rooms that were connected to the common air supply for the underground bunker, and the people who were working there with securing the jewels of the nation, the crown jewels and the paintings in World War II, they were developing stuff there, and all these kind of artworks and historical treasures which were being stored next door, the air supply was shared with a biological warfare facility. So all the people who worked without masks were getting dosed with this stuff. And then on the surface, where the air intakes and the air exhausts were coming out, were in a housing site. It was a housing, public housing.
So, okay, give us that website again.
So the secret vault, it's on YouTube. And we basically fly around with a drone. So we try to, let you see visually the story that you can then go and look up on Google and find out the background to the story. But we do it visually with drones.
Matthew Williams, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'm joined by Fran Meyer, who lives here in Bristol, not far from Stokes Croft, because actually you come into our studios here in Stokes Croft and you're disabled, so you can't be coming that far unless you've got a vehicle, Fran. I mean, just tell us a little bit about your disability and what sort of limitations it puts on where you can and can't go.
Well, now I can go do just about anything and go anywhere because I've taught myself alternative ways of doing things.
So you're actually pushing the envelope?
I certainly am.
So does that mean going on buses? How do you sort of stretch your ability to go to different places?
I do. I get on buses, certainly. And I walk when I've got to.
So tell us about your disability. What's the main problem that you've got?
Well, basically, I was pushed over in the street whilst carrying a heavy backpack on October the 20th, 2010. I sustained fractured hip, fractured pelvis and fractured upper femur. It's all healed, but it's healed in the wrong position. So now my right leg is approximately an inch shorter than my left leg and my right hip is permanently twisted, so I will be permanently on crutches.
Oh, that's annoying. But was that mistakes made in the hospital or was it,
I've no idea.
How did that happen? You were pushed over, knocked over?
What? He pushed me over. This guy pushed me over whilst I was carrying a heavy backpack and I fell heavily on my right side. And that's why I got all those injuries.
So, okay, without dwelling too much about how you got your disability, what was your first reaction when you realised that, you weren't getting better as quick as you thought you would?
I was angry. Angry at the person who did it, although I don't know, to this day I don't know who did it because I didn't see him. The only reason I knew it was a bloke was because he spoke to me, said, "Get the fuck out of the way," as he watched me fall. So I've no idea who it was.
So anger, as you started to get a bit better, how long was it before you could actually get any sort of mobility back?
It was about a year.
About a year before you could do what?
Before I could do anything really taxing for myself.
So, how did you get about before that? Were you in wheelchairs or what?
No, I to this day, I still use a Zimmer frame indoors and crutches outdoors. But in the initial period between the time when it happened and about a year afterwards, I was in so much pain I couldn't do much at all for myself.
And how did your mental attitude help you or not? Because, I mean, obviously, if you've got a disability, it can be massively limiting on what you can do. It must depend to a certain extent on your own attitude to
it. Does. Indeed, it does. Yeah, in the early, very early days, in the first 6 months or so, I was in so much pain, I was miserable all the time. But thereafter, it got considerably better in stages. And now I can do everything for myself by alternative means, but I do everything for myself.
Well, just give us some examples of the alternative means you have to use to do what, for most people, they hardly even think about.
Well, for instance, if I've got to get up and down steps, I have to make sure there's a handrail on at least one side. Getting up out of a chair if it hasn't got arms on it is difficult. No longer impossible, but still difficult. Yeah, I've just discovered alternative ways of doing absolutely everything physical.
So is it easier for you to sit in higher chairs? Is that what you look for, higher chairs to sit in? Obviously, if you're very low down, say you're in a sofa or something, it must be really difficult.
I can't get up from sofas, not generally. I've got one at home, but even before I was disabled, I couldn't get out of that.
Well, Fran, it sounds like you've got a good attitude. I wonder whether you found the austerity programme of the government difficult, because we keep hearing about disabled people being told they've got to go and get jobs, having their mobility allowances cut. There's even a group called DPAC, D-P-A-C, Disabled People Against the Cuts, who've been documenting some of the difficulties of the disabled people under austerity. And I wonder if you've found it easy. I mean, have you got all the help from the government you think you deserve?
I didn't get it initially.
So you had to fight for it?
Yes, I did.
Not good for disabled people to have to fight for those rights, is it, really?
I was applying for personal independence payment that replaced disability living allowance. I was given disability living allowance, but when they changed it over, I had to fight to get that. They sent me to Western Supermare, of all places, for the assessment.
So how did you get there?
On a bus. And because they don't tell you straight away whether you've been accepted or whether you've failed. About a week later, I got a letter through the post telling me I've been turned down for PIP. And so I took it to tribunal, and the tribunal overturned the original decision.
Okay, so was that a fairly easy thing to do? I mean, it just sounds to me like what the government seems to be doing is they seem to be rejecting a lot of people in the expectation that they will appeal and then get their money.
Yes, and I think what they're trying to do there is hoping that disabled people will be so frustrated by it they won't bother to appeal.
Well, there must be quite a few like that. What happens if they're not getting that money?
They're basically stuffed if they don't get the money.
I mean, some have even talked about disabled people being under a kind of house arrest.
Well, I imagine they would be if they were in wheelchairs or in some other way more severely impaired than I am. Yes, I think you're probably right there.
Are you in touch with other disabled people, and can you compare notes? Because one of the, by the nature of its disability, does tend to isolate people.
Yes, I used to be a member many years ago, before I was on crutches, of an organisation called Dignity for Isolated Disabled Women, more commonly known as Dignity. It doesn't exist anymore, but they were pretty good. Yeah. But I didn't need them so much then, because I was independently mobile.
They assess you.
Yeah.
What's that experience like? What do they ask you? Just take us through that.
Well, when they sent, about a week ago, they sent me for another ESA assessment.
So they do this quite regularly. So you've been assessed.
I've been assessed for PIP and for ESA. Luckily, I've discovered today when I was coming down the stairs, because the post is only in the hallway, they don't bring it up to the flats. I discovered a letter that told me that the assessment was successful, and they're actually going to raise my ESA a little bit.
Oh, well, that's good news.
Yeah, and the thing is, I got about 3 days ago, I got a phone call telling me that, and I didn't think they'd do it by phone call. But I got a letter through the post today, so they've done it officially.
But what about the assessment, the PIP assessment that you failed? Just take us through that. What sort of questions were they asking you, Fran? And did they make you do exercises, that sort of thing?
No, I don't recall they did, as a matter of fact. No, it was more questions. They had a panel of... one was a doctor, one was a social worker, and I can't remember what the other one was. But they were all women, and they asked me all sorts of... not actual exercises, but they asked me what I could do and what I couldn't do. And at that time, I could do less than I can now.
So what were they asking you? What are these sort of things, the tests that they've got? I mean, they're actually not asking you to do these things. They're asking you to say whether you can or can't do them. What is it, though, that they're putting you through? Because they're kind of hoops they're putting you through there.
Well, yes, figuratively speaking, yes. Oh, and when I went for the ESA assessment recently... They asked me to raise one leg and then raise the other leg, and I can do it now, but I couldn't when I was first assessed for it.
Do you think your attitude to your disability has made a difference to your recovery?
Absolutely. Well, basically, if I can't do something or I'm finding it very difficult to do something, I just say to myself, "Come on, Maya, get your arse in gear," and it works.
So you're really pushing yourself.
Yes, absolutely.
Not all disabled people are like that, though, are they?
I guess not.
Do you want to get a job it's good for your well-being?
I want
well-being?
To get... I don't think disabled people as a whole should be told to get work, especially if they're in this position where they can't find work. But I want to... I personally want to work.
I mean, most employers, though, will look at... you, and then they'll say, well, actually, I think it would be a lot easier and you'll probably be more productive if you're an able-bodied person,
well,
not a disabled person.
Of course they're going to say that. They've always said that to me, even when I was independently mobile. I was born with cerebral palsy, but I was always able to walk until the attack. But I was always... that's the reason why I spent 19 years cleaning public toilets, because that's the only job I could get.
So that cerebral palsy, that's quite serious, isn't it?
It depends. It comes in
a spectrum.
Yeah.
I mean, what is that, and how did it affect you?
Basically, when I was very young, I used to fall over a lot. But in those days, I could get up again. Now I can't if I fall over, and I used to shake a lot. But I think that was more to do with emotional nerves. Than cerebral palsy.
Now, back in 2010, 2011, when the Conservative government first came in, there used to be an organisation called REMPLOY, which was set up by Winston Churchill after the Second World War, which was a specialist sort of employer that focused on disabled people. Now, yeah. Is that a good plan or is that a bit patronising?
I've been there, done that and bought the T-shirt. I went with them and they didn't do anything for me at all.
Well, didn't they give you a job?
No, they did not. In fact, they haven't got... as far as I can tell, they haven't got anybody that's actually disabled working there.
Well, they're gone anyway. They've been closed down.
Good. They were useless.
Anyway, Fran, what's your advice for anyone who's listening who is either disabled themselves or knows someone who is?
In respect to what?
Well, in terms of dealing with the disability.
Like I said, positive mental attitude. Just tell yourself you can do it, even if you're finding it very difficult.
Well, Fran Meyer, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Subscribe and listen the week before broadcast, if you like, at Dialect Radio, one word, .co.uk. Thanks to our guests, that's Matthew Williams from Wiltshire and also to Fran Meyer. Also to studio engineers Dave Bazanko and Joss Chivers. Dialects, a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, catches on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us at the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk. You can talk to PRSC Arts Centre on 0117 909 6897 or The China Shop on 944 4540. Volunteer with us if you like, or for hundreds of opportunities across Britain if you've got the time, via the National Volunteering website do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till the same time next week here on Dialect, goodbye for now.
Flesh and bones, no match for sticks and stones. Look under every